Hello, everybody. Thank you, Joe, for joining us. This is Daniel Bagheri. This is our first ever ICC podcast, and we hope to bring for you many more episodes after this. But in any case, welcome to our ICC podcast. Today, we have Dr. Glenn Adams. Glenn Adams is a professor of social psychology at the University of Kansas, and also he's a Associate Director of the Kansas African Studies Center. Hello, Glenn, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for the invitation to join you.
Well, thank you for joining us. This is a platform where we're just trying to introduce the immigrant and the Iranian-Canadian community, but also the immigrant community in Canada. To issues that they might not normally have, contact with. So we thought we're going to ask you, Glenn, to be our first guest, especially because this past month we had the Indigenous Peoples Day or Indigenous Peoples Month, and in Canada we had several instances of mass graves being found, reminiscence of the tragedy of the residential schools across Canada. So we thought to have you on, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what structural racisms are, what is racism, coloniality versus colonialism, all that stuff, basically. So we're just gonna delve right into it. Glenn, can you just tell us a little bit about your work and basically your background?
Yeah, so, in terms of like long history or biography, my background is that I was born and raised and spent the first 18 years of my life in West Central Pennsylvania, a very rural area, about midway between Pittsburgh and State College, Pennsylvania, which is where Penn State University is. So the town where I grew up is sort of a old coal mining town. The primary economic activities were mining or farming. And it was one of those places that are very similar to small towns or small villages across the world. Everybody in that area sort of knew each other and had deep roots in the area. There were very few people who didn't have kind of deep roots in the area. Deep roots meaning residents, histories of, 100 years or more. So that may not qualify as deep in some places. But the point is that, compared to the mobility that people have in many modern settings, and I'll say what I mean by that later, this was a place where people grew up in the same town that their parents grew up in and their grandparents grew up in and their grandparents before them. So that's kind of, I was related to most of the people around me. So that's one important feature of that context. Another feature of the context is that religion. And it was a fundamentalist Christian church, fundamentalist Christian setting, and almost entirely homogeneously white. In the recent elections in the United States, this area is one of the strongest Trump supporting areas. So even before that, there were very few places in the United States, say, for example, in the 2008 election, that voted less Democratic than the 2004 election. So Barack Obama won the presidency because most places in the country gave him more votes than a higher percentage of votes than they gave to his Democratic predecessor in the previous election, John Kerry. So most of the counties shifted in the Democratic representation, but this county was one of the few that went in the opposite direction. So they voted a higher proportion for McCain than they did for George Bush, which just means that is an indication of the extent to which this particular place seems to be a bastion of kind of white conservativeness. And this is a little bit interesting then because of this coal mining thing. So coal mining has stopped the exploitation of the earth. They just couldn't exploit. Right. There wasn't anything to exploit. It's not that they didn't want to exploit it. They just didn't have anything to exploit. But a little bit up the hill from where I grew up was a coal cleaning plant. And this plant did nasty things to the groundwater. So it used to be the case that we would get our drinking water from a well in the ground. That's no longer possible because the water is contaminated because, you know, there's drainage ponds of toxic waste uphill from the house. But, you know, so I mentioned this not to sort of claim, you know, some kind of solidarity with oppressed peoples or something. Really, the point is to say that there is a basis here for a kind of solidarity, or there are ways in which people in that space, you know, they are suffering from a particular kind of modern colonial experience, the damage of the earth, but yet they would be among the first to complain about the federal government being intrusive and killing off their economic livelihood by imposing environmental protections or by facilitating unions, development of unions. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that many of these people 70 or 90 years ago, you know, the possibility of a middle-class lifestyle, the remote possibility of a middle-class lifestyle was made possible by unions. It's an example of this phenomenon that some people have called dying of whiteness. So they've written about it in many different places, but so people invest in policies that are harmful to them because of the symbolic value of whiteness. They get something out of being of feeling superior, feeling American exceptionalism, feeling a kind of I've started calling it like colonial narcissism.
Right.
This idea of a lifestyle that's predicated on a lifestyle of freedom and all these American kind of ideals, but it's predicated on exploitation of the earth, exploitation of other peoples. Okay, so I guess from there I went to I served in the Peace Corps after I went to my undergraduate education. They sent me to West Africa, Sierra Leone in particular. So I started to have experiences in West Africa, and this became started a long-term engagement. I'm still connected to people doing research in African settings, but I've lived and worked in West Africa for 5 years, more than 5 years at this point. And that informs a lot of what I do in my academic life, where I do research on the sociocultural foundations of mind, how it is that our experience is not just kind of encoded in brains, but we come to have the psychological experience that we do by interacting with structures of mind in context, things that have other people have deposited in the world that carry meaning. And when we encounter them, they impart to us some of the same associations and capacities that those people have designed those tools for. So it's a very anthropology friendly kind of understanding of psychology.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, because actually your experience is a little bit relevant. I mean, similar to my experience, of course. I was born Iranian Canadian, and then I traveled to Honduras, and I did my volunteer work here. And this is where you come across a lot of the issues that you pointed to: colonialism, structural racism, maybe that you mentioned colonial narcissism. And that's what interested me in the same field of anthropology, which is really, really interesting, Glenn. And it was really fascinating what you mentioned of how, you know, it's not necessarily a matter of skin color, white, brown, or black. It's just people could be victims, whether you might be, you know, Native American, indigenous, white, or poor white community. They might be victims of this idea of notions of modernity without necessarily realizing it. But before going into that, can you just explain a little bit what coloniality is and colonialism? Because in a lot of your work, you touch on this issue, colonialism, and then you try to separate it from the notion of coloniality and how that might be interacting with structures of modernity, let's say.
Yeah, so this is a distinction between colonialism and coloniality is not something that originated with me or that I sort of thought up. It's been the product of engagement with a collaborator from Costa Rica, Luis Gomez, sort of introduced me to a line of research and thinking called decolonial theory. And right. These ideas come from that perspective. And a basic idea is this notion of coloniality. So they use the word coloniality to distinguish it from colonialism. Colonialism, generally, people use that word to refer to like a historical period that it entails the occupation of one society by another, kind of taking over, dominating, extracting value from. But it's you can think of it as a discrete historical period. And in the case of many of the globe, when we think of the globe and the countries in the globe, we think of African and Asian countries, even Latin American countries colonized by Spain or Portugal, we have a sense that the colonial period is something that happened in the past and it's done. Now, there are issues, especially when we're talking about Canada or the United States,
right?
Because we don't usually think of Canada and the United States as colonial, or if we think of them as colonial in the United States, we think of the United States as being a colony of the British.
Right.
But of course, colonialism is not past yet in North America. Colonialism is ongoing because white settlers still occupy and rule the lands and dictate what happens in terms of governments, impose their laws, impose their ways of living. And that remains until this day. It's almost an invisible kind of colonialism. But still, we can think of that as colonialism because it involves the domination and occupation of land. But coloniality is a different thing. Coloniality persists even after the end of colonial rule. It refers to ways of thinking and feeling and being and knowing that came about or are associated with the historical period of colonialism. But often when colonialism ends, these ways of being have become part of everyday life. These ways of knowing have become standard. And so people continue living through these ways. So that's one important idea about coloniality. It is to the distinction between coloniality and colonialism. The consequence of that idea is that we live in a colonial present. Again, it's colonial because in some places colonialism hasn't ended, but in the globe generally, coloniality persists. Coloniality in the form of white supremacy, or what I referred to earlier as American exceptionalism, this idea that there's a certain way to be that is natural, and that way to be is the way that European societies have evolved to be or emerged to be. European societies and, you know, settler societies in other contexts. And that sort of sets the norm for a lot of the world and institutions we inhabit. Okay. The other important idea about coloniality that decolonial theorists talk about is they talk about it as the underside or dark side of modernity, that you can't really separate out modernity from coloniality. Anytime you think about modern, particularly the Eurocentric modern, that kind of modernity that sort of rules the world is inherently linked to coloniality.
Right.
For two reasons. Historically, it's linked because the historical processes that built Europe, the materiality, the material wealth, the accumulation of capital that enabled the cultural advancement. So we tend to think of things like the Enlightenment as about ideas and not necessarily about things or resources. It's just cultural development, ideas. People had these intellectual developments, not technological developments, or not made possible by concentration of wealth. But decolonial theorists make us think about the ways that colonialism provided, colonial empire provided material and ideological resources for those kind of cultural developments to happen. And especially, and this is relevant for my field of psychology, the idea of the individual, like right. The individual abstracted from social context, that very modern idea, that idea that informs the, you know, the United States Declaration of Independence and a lot of the liberal humanities, reflecting the work of philosophers like John Locke and Rousseau, the idea of the individual being inherently separate from society and society being somehow a product of those individuals. And Descartes, of course, this idea of rationality sort of being separate from affect. So those ideas came about because of the wealth that afforded this idea that you were free from material constraint.
Right.
And most humans do not inhabit situations where they're free of material constraint. Many people live hand to mouth, day to day, very much constrained by environmental circumstances. But this accumulation of wealth allowed a lot of people to have this experience of freedom from constraint, gave them the time to pursue these intellectual things and develop these ideas and to develop a society where that was possible for a lot of people. But now we take that to be nature, or we take that to be the norm, or that has become elevated as a standard. We call it, you know, modern individualism. But decolonial theorists emphasize that modernity and modern individualism are products of coloniality. There's coloniality built into them in their source and built into them in their consequences. And that's the reason for that example of my own life and the sort of, by pursuing these particular kinds of modern individualist lifestyles, we are reproducing the violence of coloniality and sort of white supremacy and global domination. That's at least the theory or the ideas that emerge from a decolonial theoretical perspective. So that's what I've borrowed from the decolonial theorists to try to think about what we will call cultural variation in ways of being. When we see different ways of being, trying to understand what is good about this way and what are its downsides, but also what is good about the other way and what are its downsides. And fields like psychology or Western knowledge generally, because they often do what, you know, you might recognize as ethnocentrism. So they tend to see their ways as they tend to view these things through their own in-group biased lens, what they think is normal and good, and project that onto other spaces. So the work that I do tries to compare settings or look at research, look at phenomena like love or well-being in a Ghanaian context, and use that not to know about Ghanaian settings so much, but rather to use that as a way to think about hegemonic psychology or the way we do things in mainstream psychology in American universities, because it allows us to think through some of the downsides of the ways of being that you wouldn't think of if you just thought of them as part of modern progress. If you think about the coloniality of them, you can see them in a different way.
So I guess it's really interesting because I can see the intersectionality here between what you mentioned, how you're interested in the structures of mind, how maybe cultural, social settings, let's call it modernity, that's maybe intertwined with this coloniality, how that has an impact on our mental structures as individuals, as a community, as a group. Is that where the intersection is here for you as well, where you look at how coloniality kind of impacts how we view ourselves and how we view our society and our position within society?
Yeah, I've always been interested in the idea that if you're interested in liberation, or if you want to be less grandiose, just social change or positive social justice, there's a psychological component to it, and that in order to solve the problem, one has to resolve the kind of structural economic issues. But even if you just make everything equal by sort of awarding, you resolve all the inequality, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that the that you'll solve the problem, because the ways of being can reproduce it. So people, the structures get into people, and people can reproduce the structures by their everyday action. In fact, the structures require that people reproduce them. And we often reproduce them through things that are not in our conscious awareness. We might even prefer to act differently, but we make choices that reproduce those kind of oppressive realities. So I think that's where, I guess if I had to say yes or no to your question, I would say yes, but that's the way in which I would say yes, that this idea of mutually constituting. So the problem lies in the psychological side too. I mean, the problem with psychology is that they tend to treat things like racism almost exclusively as problems of bad individuals, and they don't think about how
it's part of the structures.
The structures. So it's a little bit of an opposite problem. But this idea is important too. There are thinkers like Frantz Fanon, and these now become important in decolonial theory, but also writers like Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, who wrote Decolonizing the Mind. They make the point, or Hussein Bulhan or Steve Biko. There are many people writing about this idea of psychological colonization. Ashish Nandi in India, the idea that colonialism did not just occupy land, but it also occupied minds and implanted certain ways of being into those minds. And in the African case, you know, there's the problem has been that the countries have independence. The Europeans are gone. People are ruling themselves, but very early on, even in the first country to regain independence, Ghana, the president, Kwame Nkrumah, coined the term neocolonialism to refer to these relations that didn't seem to provide complete independence. He didn't necessarily refer to it in psychological terms, but it's the problem that people are trying to wrestle with. And this is where people like Ngugi Wa Thiong'o start talking about the colonization of the mind, control over, and that you know, Ngugi says that or writes that he believes that's the most profound or most important kind of colonization, that the strongest weapon was education and sort of changing people's worldview, changing what they thought progress was, changing what they thought the purpose of a life was, the relationship to the earth, the relationship to other people, what constitutes status and who's a worthy human being. Colonization changed those things. It changed people's wants. It changed their feelings, their strivings. And once infected with this, even when colonial power left, this remained.
That's very interesting. Yeah, and I guess Fanon also points to that in his work, that, long after, let's say, the official colonialism has ended, it's the structures that remain in people's mind that end up reproducing, let's say, the same violence or even the same structures of racism in the body of the nation state system, for example, and, everyday socioeconomic interactions of people. Do you think that is also a... do you feel that this is a phenomenon in the context of North America, let's say Canada and the United States? And I say that because, especially for example, as an immigrant, when you come here, there's always this comparison that goes on in your head. You know, well, for many of us, Canada is kind of seen as a refuge. We leave our countries, leave our war-torn countries, let's say, or problems from what we perceive to be problems in our own home countries, our countries of origin, and we come to Canada, you know, in pursuit of a better life. But of course, there's always this comparison. We might think, oh, our country is bad because, of course, we're doing something wrong, or because, of course, we lack the culture, or we lack the ways of being that, for example, Canada can produce. And this is why they're like this. But many of us don't really think about, you know, maybe those, you mentioned structural racism or maybe structural divisions or whatnot that might be also at play that, you know, that creates a division between us and them. So we kind of judge ourselves too. We say, well, our country is all bad because we're made of bad peoples, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, right. So now we're seeing in the Canadian case, we're seeing evidence of some of that violence that happened in the production of Canada. So yes, as coming as a newcomer, you know, the society seems to work, the electricity seems to flow, the roads seem to work, the courts seem to work. There, you know, there are problems here or there, but people generally can find some measure of recourse, it seems. You know, but it seems, but it depends who we're talking about, who is the we that I was referring to when I said we, but also the thing we have to recognize or we don't think of is the historical process that produced Canada. And it wasn't an empty territory. They didn't right. just come here and occupy some place that wasn't occupied. There first had to be a dispossession. And it was very violent in various degrees. In some cases, people ceded their lands to the Canadian government in return for some kind of agreement or treaty. In Canada and the United States, people often didn't honor those agreements. And in some cases, they just took the land and didn't give an agreement. So it was unceded territory. So that's a form of violence. But then the boarding schools, this idea of these languages, these ways of knowing are backward. They're not suitable for our present circumstance. So in fact, they're unhealthy. And really, if we have to bring these people into the modern era, and that's why we have to take them and, you know, train them in English. And in the United States, people said things like, well, first of all, there were sort of outright hostility. So there's a very famous Secretary of the Interior in the United States who said something to the effect of the only good Native is a dead Native. The only good Indian is a dead Indian, they said. Okay.
Right.
Another Secretary of the Interior who came after this one was presenting a more tolerant or civilized face. They said he would agree with it only to a certain extent, which is that in order that you had to kill the Indian to save the person, to save the man. The idea being that if you want to save people and enable them, that it's not about outright genocide, it's about cultural genocide, really. You have to kill the bad aspects of these societies by educating people in Eurocentric modern understandings of the way the world is. Now, we can think of that as ethnocentrism, which is the way I generally used to think of it as well, but it's also a manifestation of kind of this idea that modernity is the way of progress, and it's just the future. It's not like a particular cultural development. It just seems like this is the way that human beings have mm-hmm. advanced, and we don't often see the downsides of it. But in the North American case, we can see now, and in the global case, there's a return to thinking through problems from Indigenous knowledge standpoints, because we're starting to see some of the cracks of the modern system.
Right.
Neoliberal individualism doesn't solve all the problems. We're having problems of governance. We're having problems of overconsumption and environmental degradation. We're not living in relationship with each other or the earth because of that myth that we're abstracted from context and that modern delusion, which leads us to do things without thinking about the long-term consequences or the broader social consequences. That the modern mentality pushes people to do that.
Right.
Indigenous ways of knowing and Indigenous worldviews are generally, not to overgeneralize, but many of them do involve this understanding of one's inherent relatedness. And because of that, you know, there's kind of maybe it's apocryphal, but there's that idea that some, I think it's even Dhanashani, there's a wisdom that says, whenever we're making a decision, we think about seven generations, how it will affect them to seven generations from now. So it's
right,
because that's sort of the span of who we are. We is not ended here in this generation now, but we're connected through time and through connection to land, because we have the we have the anticipation that my land, the land where I'm standing, is going to be the same place where those seven generations are going to stand. In our high mobility modern lifestyle, we don't feel like we have a connection to any particular place. We could fit any place. I mean, migrants to Canada have some understanding of this. I have this belief, understanding of myself in terms of mobility as well. Otherwise, I'd still be in central Pennsylvania, connected to that situation that I grew up in. So we have the freedom of mobility that has afforded us a lot of important things. But that kind of lifestyle, the lack of connection to place, or connection to place, or not having that same connection that your families may have had for a long time, comes with different ideas about the world. And some of those ideas are killing the world.
Right.
The modern idea.
And in fact, that's interesting that you mentioned that. In your articles, you refer to a concept called weird ways. Can you explain that concept, and then how is that related to what you just said in terms of, like, you know, those concepts that might be kind of programmed in our way of thinking of how to be modern, but maybe we're not necessarily aware of it. And then goes back to issues of, let's say, structural racism. And if you can maybe explain that a little bit, you know, maybe there are these, not so overtly systems of violence that are operating on our mindsets and on how we view ourselves, let's say, as racialized peoples, that we may not be aware of it. You know, we're constantly, for example, trying to live up to an image of what it means to be modern, then it's quite possible that we will never be able to live up to those concepts. I don't know if you can, maybe, I think that might be very useful for our audience who might be listening in.
Yeah, so, first of all, the weird idea. So this idea, again, it's just something I use, but other people sort of coined the term. In fact, there are researchers at UBC, University of British Columbia. They have been doing comparisons or studying how the field of psychology and a lot of other liberal arts in the academy tend to understand the person, or understand species typical tendencies, or what a normal person does, or what a normal society is, through a very individualist lens. And so they're trying to come up with a word to describe that set of tendencies, and especially to contrast it with its place in the world. So its place in academia, it seems like the way the world is, the way people are. It's the hegemonic form. But what they wanted to suggest is that it's really a very particular and historically deviant form that we sort of hold up to be normal, and that informs our theorizing about the world. So they wanted a word that would do that, an acronym that would do that. Weird fits that, but it also fits the kind of societies that they're talking about, the kind of circumstances that promote the tendencies of modern individualism, is what I would call it. But those letters of the acronym in their original formulation stand for Western, educated, industrial, rich, and democratic. I like to say supposedly democratic, because they were counting places like the United States, which was slipping in the rankings of democracy. But they did research in a lot of different settings and reviewed research from a lot of different settings, and showed that the kind of things that psychologists take to be standard and normal and typical of human beings are actually true of that limited set of settings, that weird set of settings.
Right.
Now, to your structural racism point. that research and in psychology generally and in cultural psychology, people have not been very attentive to race or power. So they would describe that difference, that weirdness, as kind of cultural developments, but not think about what were the source of those cultural developments. And when they did think about the source, they didn't think of it in terms of coloniality and race and racial power.
Right.
But the idea of coloniality suggests that those weird ways of being didn't emerge just through innocent cultural development, but they emerged in the context of, or, you know, they maybe weren't invented completely. Of course, there are expressions of individualism all over the place, even in the ancient world, mm-hmm. but they emerged more prominently and in their existing form, really through the European Enlightenment and all the things that happened in Eurocentric modernity. And that is a product of coloniality.
Right.
Even within social psychology, there's a thing called the frontier hypothesis, which suggests that individualism, that the frontier, the North American frontier, gave rise to or was a set of conditions that was very conducive to the emergence of American individualism. And even now in the American West and in the Canadian West, you see that a kind of libertarianism or anti-government kind of don't mess with me or self-reliance. Right. Mm-hmm. You think about the typical Alberta stereotype. So
right.
In Canada, it's even today, the frontier kind of gives rise to this kind of individualism, but that theory doesn't mention the fact that the frontier was a frontier of colonial appropriation. It was the frontier between European settlement and the lands that people were expropriating. So without necessarily saying it, they're making a link between the coloniality and the emergence of individualism. So structural racism, you can think of it in terms of, most people I think of structural racism in terms of kind of policies or institutions that make for differential treatment regardless of prejudice. So psychologists tend to think about, and many white folks tend to think about racism as prejudice, which is a very individualizing thing. They think of racism as mostly about bigots and people who hate and are ignorant and intolerant. You know, maybe they storm the US Capitol, they engage in hate speech,
right.
But not really the things they do. Or they're willing to admit individual bias. It's a kind of safer construction. They don't tend to see systemic or structural racism to the same extent that many Black and Brown people do. But I think when they think of structural racism, they think of things like, okay, the prison system or the way policing works. So in Toronto, for example, certain people are more likely, the police are more likely to stop certain people than they are other people, and that's racialized, and other forms of difference too, but racialized. Or home ownership and practices of lending. These are all kind of institutional things that maybe they have an explicitly racist component. Maybe they're just the vestige of some kind of historical inequality, but they reproduce racial difference and racial outcomes.
Right.
I think that coloniality includes like a more psychological component of it too. And the weirdness, my colleagues and I have started to amend the weirdness from the Western educated, industrial, rich, and democratic to white. So calling it maybe WHEIRD. To reinforce the idea that it's not just kind of natural cultural development, but this racialized way of being. And in essence, what weirdness is a kind of white subjectivity, white ways of being imposed on the world. So anywhere you live and when you travel across the globe, or you aspire to work in the global marketplace, the rules you're going to work by and live by are, by and large, those weird ways of being. And people's aspirations and subjectivity and sense often conforms to those weird ways of being. And if those things are set up, so I think that's a manifestation of structural racism that's sort of embedded in culture. We elevate things that are white ways of being and think that those are good. Mm-hmm. So romantic love. So this idea that couples, this is some research that I do, or a topic that I do some research on, was a sort of valorization of romantic love between two people who decide to get together, and they sort of become enraptured with each other. They become companions, intimate. And that is in these systems that we inhabit, this kind of Disney love, that's supposed to be the happy ever after. That's supposed to be the source of a person's investment. We don't often talk about the fact that that's at the expense of a broader set of connections that you might call family or kin, that in many parts of the world and in human history have been the primary source of people's belonging, because you had to work together in these units on your sustenance and survival. And people would make arrangements for marriage because it was required for social reproduction, but that often was a corporate exercise, and people got integrated into these pre-existing communities, and they might not act as your best friends. You got together and did your responsibilities to each other, but your primary connections were with kin and maybe same gender age mate friend things. But this is an example of the way that, you know, and it's not that people are just trying to mimic the West. There are a lot of enticements about that kind of romantic love. There are a lot of things that are motivating about it. There are a lot of things that make you feel good when you do it. Maybe there's no better feeling in the world. But the indulgence of that and the elevation of that to the status of something to aspire rather than something to guard against has consequences, is not necessarily self-evident that should be the thing that we should emphasize. It comes with a set of commitments and values. And to the extent that we don't think about that, to the extent that we just accept it naturally, we've already fallen into a kind of coloniality, and which in this case we can define as a racialized form of construction of normal and natural.
Right.
In a white image. It's like God, it's like, you know, in God's image, but God's image is white.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So in other words, these are, let's say, maybe archetypes of what modernity is, archetypes of how we should be, that's considered to be superior, that we tend to reproduce in our daily interactions and in daily practices. And so I guess my next question would be, you know, as racialized community, or let's say as immigrant communities, you know, would we be somehow, is it possible, first of all, is it possible to be racist, or in other words, to be able to be projecting those structural racism, or to maybe embody a white subjectivity, or let's say weird subjectivity, and reproduce it essentially? So in other words, do you have to be white in order to reproduce white subjectivity? Because of course, and I say this because in my own community, there is often a confusion, and there is an identity crisis in our own community. I mean, part of our community may appear white, I mean, you know, lighter skin and whatever, but other parts could be much darker and whatnot. So there's this ambiguity, and we don't know how to define ourselves. But nevertheless, we tend to project ourselves as, you know, super progressive and super Western and whatnot. And we don't think that we might be racist. We don't, because we're an immigrant community. So, well, we can never really be racist. I just wanted to get your, you know, input on that.
Yeah. That's a good question. And one that I hear a lot. I asked that question in a comprehensive exam yesterday to a student, sort of in a way. So the way I get the question a lot is somebody, you know, Lawrence, Kansas.
Yes.
We both know Lawrence, Kansas. So yes. There was a particular pub there where the university has a practice of academics giving a talk, and then people are drinking beer or eating dinner while the academic gives a talk. So I did this at one point, and the person asked me at the end of it, I was doing a talk on group differences and perception of racism, the fact that white folks in the United States tend to deny the extent of systemic racism, something that we've talked about
here. Yes.
But in this talk, somebody asked me, you know, basically they said, can people of African descent be racist? Can Black people be racist?
Exactly, yeah.
And I said, well, okay, I think what you mean when you say that is, can they, can a person of African descent be prejudiced against a white person, or can they be racist against a white person? Or if they hate or dislike a white person because the person is white, is that racism? That's probably what they're saying. Mm-hmm. And because of course people can have that kind of dislike or hatred. Yes, that's possible. Do we call that thing racism? And I suggested to them, no, but that doesn't mean, but I would still answer your question, yes. So I would answer that question, no, that's not racism. But can a Black person be racist? Yes. First of all, David Roediger, who is a professor at the University of Kansas, whose work you might know, a very nationally famous professor, he wrote a book called The Wages of Whiteness. Mm-hmm. But he gave one answer to that question, which is, of course, he was present at the talk. He said that, you know, race and racism and racial relations are not a binary thing. It's not just a white-Black thing. So a person of African descent can act with, can enact racism by beating up Asian American immigrants or Asian American citizens. They can do it by performing racist acts against indigenous peoples in the United, in North America. But the other important thing is, I think what I said to the person is that I think a Black person can be racist even within sort of binary white-Black relationships, but it's not by sort of, I wouldn't call prejudicial treatment toward white folks racism. Instead, I would say an action that supports white supremacy, an action that supports coloniality, which there are many of them, that that is my definition of racism. And yes, people can enact racism. Whether they can be racist, I am not very much inclined to like put racism inside of people. I think that people act through systems, and maybe even if they would disavow the ideology, they nevertheless many times will act in ways that reproduce that ideology. So I think a good example, I happen to be reading something in the news and following these chains of articles, and there are some artists, for example, some musical artists or rap artists, who will espouse ideology, you know, say, disparage, there was one particular one in the story that I read disparaging Emmett Till, who was a person who was a 14-year-old boy in the 1950s who white supremacists kidnapped and tortured and killed. But that's an example of sort of reproducing white supremacist ideology or reproducing coloniality. And that serves the interests of white supremacy, and in my definition, that would be racist. So many immigrant peoples, when they settle in a country, yeah, they face racism, but that doesn't mean they can't also enact racism on other groups, certainly indigenous peoples. There are some people who argue that, you know, to purchase land without engaging the indigenous owners of the land and to occupy that land sort of reproduces the settler colonial state and is contributes to this notion of racist colonial occupation. And if you're settling there, some maybe doesn't matter, it matters in shades of degree, but not necessarily a different kind, that they would put that in the bucket of racism. So that's one example. But even within communities, you know, you mentioned skin color. So people often discriminate on the basis of skin color. I think research in social psychology and other fields suggest that People who have darker skin might have more difficulty finding a mate, even within communities. So even within the Iranian community, if dark skin is a liability and you are making your choices, whether you know it or not, based on what you think is attractive, and people are systematically excluded to the extent that they don't match the white ideal, that,
right.
That is a form of racism, according to this analysis.
And that's really interesting. And you know, when you mentioned you produced an example with a black, a black person kind of producing the same racist systems, essentially. Something came to my mind during the Trump administration, for example. I remember watching a documentary when a lot of Cuban Americans were Trump supporters. They would march alongside of Trump supporters. In fact, rallying against, for example, immigrants, Hispanic immigrants, basically using a lot of the similar rhetorics that you would suspect, white majority Republicans would, you would hear them produce the same similar rhetoric. Could that be an example also? So, for example, these community members would rally against, for example, Cuba itself. They said Cuba is a leftist dictatorship. Immigrants, and I'm generalizing, immigrants that are generally, a lot of them are illegal. They're producing, crimes in our community and things like that. And, again, promoting that weird concept of progress.
I think that's a good example. I want to ask if we can pause for a moment because I hear an alarm going.
Okay, sorry, we're back. I was just giving an example of the Cuban Americans who are, let's say, marching along Trump supporters. That might be an example of producing weird or white ways, essentially, in the immigrant community.
Yes, and I think that's a good example. I mean, of course, many of the people in the Cuban American community in Florida are people who are more advantaged under the colonial system. They tend to be lighter skinned or white. And so there's a racialization to the population in South Florida vis-a-vis the people who may be coming more recently, or the government in Cuba. But I think, and there may be a similar situation among the Iranian diaspora, the Persian diaspora too.
Yeah.
So the earlier waves are more likely perhaps to have some connection to the
conservative
old regime.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. They may have some reservations about newcomers, particularly from Iran. But even more generally, it's not necessarily the case that people of Mexican descent in the United States are the most welcoming toward immigrants from Mexico. It's there's more opposition than one might imagine.
Yeah.
Similarly, there's a lot of tension in the United States between African Americans and African immigrants. That's often a topic for discussion of graduate students in African studies programs, for example. So it's especially with the case of immigrants, there can be, and of course, immigrants and indigenous peoples, there's a tension there as well, because,
right.
Again, immigrants often feel some measure of disadvantage and some measure of hostility from the society that they're coming to, the host country. But indigenous peoples may see it as, just more and more settlers coming to occupy their land.
That's a good point. So are we producing settler culture by being immigrants, Glenn?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I think that one should think about it, though, and think about, and it is the case, we should say, that in the United States, for example, indigenous peoples often demonstrate on behalf of migrants. So it's not the case that people are, you know, I'm sure there are some people who would join a militia and patrol the border, but a lot of people are maybe offering their space as refuge. So because, and part of it, so it's not, there is a way in which, you know, people in societies can be welcoming to other people. But the question is, so the question is about whose terms are we settling on? Whose laws are we going to agree with? So an immigrant in many cases comes to a society and agrees to live by the rules of that society. They don't have the hubris to say, well, I'm going to come here and I'm going to do exactly what I want. You're right. Saying, okay, look, this is kind of your space, and hopefully I'm going to be able to do what I want to do, but you know, I'm going to drive on the right side of the road or left side of the road, depending on what you say everyone's going to do here. We're going to put our trash out on the day that people say they're going to do the trash. We're going to try to do things in the way that people, but that's not what the settlers did. The settlers said, no, we're going to set up our own place with our own rules and not but live by your rules, and maybe not right. even respect them as something that we have to respect. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the more problematic thing. So in thinking about how to live ethically, you know, on stolen land, or how to honor people who the dispossessed of the land, how That's do we right. do that now is a good question.
So I guess this brings us near to the end. And I want to just leave off on a positive note, possibly if there is any. But I wanted to ask you, Glenn, what does decoloniality look like? How do we practice decoloniality in our communities, you know, as even white folks and or as immigrant community, or as racialized peoples?
Yeah, well, I think that
and you don't have to have an answer to that either.
Yeah. I think what I was going to say is that I'm biased in the direction of the intellectual, for lack of a better word. So I tend to think about things in terms of like thinking and ideas and knowledge, and whose mm-hmm. knowledge or what knowledge are we going to live by. And for me, a decolonial approach would be, Nelson Maldonado Torres talks about a decolonial attitude.
Right.
And I think that what is a big part of a decolonial attitude for me is a kind of epistemic humility, to understand the limits of where, of one's knowledge, and to really think through what one thinks is natural and normal, and to recognize the possibility that it has a connection to racial power and this kind of worship of Eurocentric modernity, which, by the way, the discussion we had today, this idea system didn't come up, but critical race theory, which is in the news a lot, has very right. similar ideas as decolonial theory when it comes to the notion of in decolonial theory, I talked about it as the sort of coloniality inherent in modernity. Critical race theorists emphasize the extent to which European, American society, Canadian society is inherently racist or inherently race
based or
relevant, right. racialized,
right.
and race pervades it. So thinking about that, I think decolonial theorists often say that even calling something coloniality is already a decolonial act, because one is understanding and denaturalizing the world that one inhabits. It's not a natural, it's a colonial product. And then one can better maneuver through the world with that realization rather than living in ignorance of it.
That's a really good advice, Glenn. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Sorry, I think you might be frozen, Glenn.
Are you still? I'm okay. Okay. I just didn't have anything else to say, and I was watching it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Glenn. It was a pleasure, and thank you so much for your time. You know, I think as an immigrant community, we could really take a lot of great, like you said, it's a challenging our sources of knowledge, sources of, you know, or just questioning our perception itself could be a very decolonial act. And that's a really positive note to get to end on. And I just wanted to thank you, Glenn, for giving us your time and your expertise. We really do appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for the invitation. And I do think, yes, that many immigrant communities have resources for because they know of other ways of being, whereas maybe a fifth generation Canadian has just, you know, drunk the Kool-Aid, as they say.
Well, thank you so much. We hope to have you on again, maybe in the future. Maybe if you have questions, I could later ask you and I can answer our audience myself if you don't have time. But we really do appreciate it. Thank you so much, Glenn. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, everybody.